he had had some experience, but it was really quite limited. He'd started a number of little accessory building manufacturing sites and companies, and continued on with that even after he was associated with American Motors. But he really didn't have a grasp of that enormous tooling time and the effort it takes to get into, you know, re-engineering cars, and re-engineering cars from an existing one in the case of the Javelin, or there was one run that was made under his prodding, and that was a run on that same vehicle on the AMX to have an all fiberglass vehicle on a platform, and rather than, of course, a frame or anything like that. And there were a couple or three of those built. One is still in existence over in Kenosha. And they were actually running cars. They spent a lot of money on that program before we decided that really was not the thing to do from a body structural standpoint and tooling costs and manufacturing problems and all the other things that were associated with that kind of a program. So it really boiled down to the best answer, which was taking the Javelin and shortening it and utilizing as much of the Javelin as we could and still camouflage it to the degree that we could in order to convert it from a four-place to a two-place vehicle. And of course that, as I mentioned, involved quarter panels. We were able, however, to save the bumper and the deck lid and the backlight and the roof. The roof was new. The roof had to be new, of course. But we did use a great deal of the underpinnings and even the outer panels. Of course, the door was standard Javelin. And so it was a fun project. And when it was all completed, there was really quite a marked difference between the four-place vehicle, the Javelin, and the two-place vehicle, the AMX. And that was really, looking back on it, was really a fun program. I know when they introduced it down at Daytona, the two-passenger car, approximately the time of Speed Week down there, the reception of that car was fantastic. I know Roger Ward led a pack of those things around that oval down at Daytona at top speed, and that was the first time the press had actually gotten a look at them. That was actually the long lead press showing of the two-passenger car. And I was down there, and Vic Raviola, who has since gone to his reward, was down there. I was down there with him, and we had a great time, and showing that car, and the reception was overwhelming on that car. It did exactly what not only I felt should happen, but all the marketing people and the other people, and of course eventually we got Mark Donahue into the act, and he did the Texas takeover down in Texas with a run, high-speed run with a specially modified two-passenger AMX, and all of this hype and all of the publicity that the Javelin and the AMX, that pair of cars generated, I think really did so much for the company that you couldn't even hardly calculate it, because what they had done, by doing this with the help of Bill McNeely and all his marketing people, they had really taken us out of the Rambler owner category, the old name Rambler, which of course is long gone now. But there were all kinds of snide remarks made before the Javelin AMX got there. And we did a lot of other special cars too, the SC360 and the Matador Machine and things like that, about this same general time frame. And all of these things that were happening really, really helped bring the company up from kind of a mom and pop car building company. And we were now accepted by certainly the youth of the country as being able to put out cars that would be fully competitive with a lot of the things that GM, Ford, and even Chrysler were doing. And it was mandatory, really, that we get into that thing at that time, because this was, you know, in the muscle car period. In fact, we were a little late getting into that. I can remember that we were very concerned that the biggest standard engine we had was a 401 at that time. Although of course, we never offered the 401 in the smaller cars, but the 401 was considered to be kind of a small engine in those days, because everybody else had, you know, 427s and things like that. But that 401 V8 was looked upon as being, you know, kind of small in the scheme of things, and it was impossible, according to our engine people, to make it very much larger without having very expensive and serious problems to manufacture it. In any event, the whole Javelin and AMX story was one that I look back on. In fact, I made the comment a couple of times that those really were the kind of Camelot years to me at AMC. I guess for a lot of reasons. Number one, the fact that I've always been extremely interested in sports and competition cars, and this fit right into the things that I liked very much, at least. And I really think that whole program was probably did more than any one thing to kind of pull us out of the reputation of being Ma and Pa kettle car builders. And there were jokes, as I say, at the time about, well, the head of the sports car group in some little southern town, which they'd make up, this guy was drove a Rambler, you know, that sort of thing, and that really hurt. And I know from my own personal experience with my kids that you know, we did have a reputation before the Javelin and AMX of building kind of stodgy old four-door sedans and winning the economy, mobile economy run every year with Les Veland and his Lightfoot, which was good too, certainly, but that was a different type of a program. And I know one time I was driving my son, who was going over to Berkshire over here, and driving him to school. And when I drive him over there, he'd say, "Well, look, let me off here, Dad. It's you know, it's only about a block away, and I've got some buddies I'm going to meet here." And I didn't catch on about the third or fourth time that he was kind of embarrassed to be seen driving up in a, you know, Rambler two-door, four-door wagon or whatever I was driving at the time. So, you know, even kids, he was about 12 or 13, I guess, at the time, and even at that age, they kind of scoffed at, you know, we were just not in with the group that we wanted to influence.
Well, certainly the AMC and the Javelin, especially AMX, has been regarded as a classic since then.
Yeah, it has. As a matter of fact, I've got one across in the garage here now that is a very, very fine example of that. It's Big Bad Orange, and it has a 390 engine and all of the toys, as the guys call them. And it has, you know, it is an automatic, which to the true, I guess, sports car guy, they kind of look down their nose a little bit at that, but it is an automatic BorgWarner unit in there before we went to the Chrysler unit. None of the Javelins or AMXs, the early ones at least, had the Chrysler transmission. They had a BorgWarner unit. But anyway, it is a fine example of that. And it's a 69. We built those in about half of 68 and all of 69 and into 70 as far as the two-passenger car is concerned. We built a total of about a little over 19,000 total vehicles. And then we switched to the 2 plus 2, the Javelin AMX, which I was really never very much for. But because I felt that at that time we had Bill Lundeberg, who was president of the company and a hell of a nice guy, but I didn't agree with him in a lot of areas, particularly that one, because he said that the sales of the then 1970 AMX were rapidly falling off, and of course Ford long before that had switched to a four-place car after the 55, 6, and 7 vehicles many years before, but they were no longer building a two-place type car. And kind of added fuel to his fires, at least, to say, "Hey, well, look, why don't we take, it's not going to hurt at all, Teague, just go ahead and, you know, do your thing with a 2 plus 2, and we'll put it on a longer wheelbase," and he was a manufacturing guy. It'll be a lot easier to manufacture, and yeah, you can have a new hood, and you can have a new grill, and you can have all these things, but it really was never the same, because there's no way that you can, you know, really get the kind of feeling and the youth appeal in a 2 plus 2, even, that you can with a two-place vehicle. So anyway, we forged ahead, and I made a hell of a last ditch run at having a 71 two-passenger car. In fact, I took the car that I was driving, which of course was a 68, and I'd kept it and modified it and brought it up to date through the years, not very many years, two and a half, but I liked that car so well, and I'd had a I put a 401 engine in it, and they tweaked the engine. It had a Mark Donahue engine in it at one time. And it was really a beautiful car. It was white and with red trim. And I thought that in order to try to convince Bill Lundeberg that we should carry on the two-passenger, even though, as he said, and the facts were there, the two-passenger, the dealers were saying, hey, the two-passenger is nice, but the Javelin's doing well, and why don't you... it was probably some dealer from Keokuk, Iowa or something that convinced him that we ought to drop the two-passenger and make a 2 plus 2 AMX and call it Javelin. I mean, I don't know where that came from, but it sailed through the door one day. And but in an effort to try to sort that, I took my own personal car and put on a front-end envelope that had the 71 blister fenders on it. And it didn't turn out too bad. And I came within a hair's breadth of being able to sell that to Lundeberg. But he still came back with the figures that said, hey, and there's no way of proving, to this day, what would have happened had we done that and carried it on one more year, if it would have stopped the sales slide or not. I just don't know. There's no way that anybody could tell. But that car was extremely well received by a limited number of dealers that saw it, and of course people around AMC, not only in styling, of course they loved it, but even some of the engineers and others. And I did as much as I could to convince Lundeberg. I had all kinds of proselyting devices going on to talk some of the marketing people into it and so forth. But Lundeberg is a very strong guy, and he felt, God bless him for his opinion, he really felt that we should just drop that two-passenger, difficult to manufacture because it's a shorter wheelbase and all the special quarter panels and things that we had in the car and the underbody was shortened, of course, too. And he just felt that the car had done what it had set out to do, and we'd built nearly 20,000 of them, and why not just stop building it? But I did get the opportunity, and Bill was good about that. He gave me the opportunity of having a formal presentation on it, and I had it in on the turntable, and it was all, we repainted it, and it was sitting there, and it was really an impressive car, I thought, and I really thought I had it in the bag. I thought, well, yeah, he's gonna let me carry that over another year, and maybe if I got that year, then I'd go on to the next one, and so forth. But it was not to be, and that car survives today. In fact, I just heard last week that the fellow that wound up with that car after I was through with it, and this is many years ago, of course, he has decided he's going to do a full frame-up restoration on it. And he's, in fact, doing that. He's going to have it at Kenosha next year in 1986. So the car, that one-off car, kind of still lives. It really was a make from an earlier model, but it might have been the 71 two-passenger AMX, but little point in history that means nothing, I guess, today, but that's the way it was. About the time the Jerry Myers came on the scene, generally in this period, he had started out in manufacturing and had worked in purchasing and a couple of other places, coming up the ladder. He felt that a two-passenger car had a terrific future. Also, although he was also on a little bit different tact, he felt that, and that it was a good tact for sure, but of course we all knew that Ford were working on a mid-engine car to replace some of the vehicles that they had in the line and kind of upgrade their total two-passenger offerings. Actually bring them back in this case. But so they were working a car called the Pantera. I forget the name of it. There was another code name on that before that, but in any event, it wound up being, as we know it today, the Pantera, which is still built in limited numbers, even in 1985 in Europe, in much modified form by Di Tommaso.
Was that
the Mangusta was another animal. That was built by Di Tommaso's company, but a different car. But he has another variant of the original Pantera. It doesn't look much like it, but it still lives in limited edition production over there. But anyway, we knew that Ford were working on this mid-engine car, and so between Jerry Myers and myself and McNeely and several others, we thought we'd make a run at trying to do a a rather expensive sports car. It was going to be a different kind of an animal than the two passenger that we were even at that point planning on dropping. And this would really have been kind of a replacement for that, although it would have appealed to a different demographic group. And it would have been right on the button with Pantera as far as money is concerned. The selling price was like $10,000, which doesn't seem like much today, but in those days it was a lot of money because you could buy it. In fact, I've got the stickers on the orange car across the way here, and it's under $4,000. So here we're talking about a car that was, you know, 2.5 times as expensive as that. And it would have the appeal of being a European-built vehicle. And it would have the appeal of being a mid-engine, of course. And it would be called AMX something. At that time, we hadn't really concluded that it would be called the AMX 3, which it ultimately was dubbed. And so we set about on this program to design this car. And we did two runs at that. The first one was called AMX 2. And it gets a little confusing in the history of things because there were other twos and other threes and things like that. But in any event, this was a vehicle that we were, it was a two-place vehicle, and it was called AMX 2. And we later did the 3, of course. But on the AMX 2, there was never a running car built of that first clay model that we made. We made a fiberglass model from the clay model. It was the same wheelbase as the later one, the 3. But it was quite a different looking car from that. It had a spine down the back between separating had two rear windows, flat glass windows in the back, and the whole general shape and contour and the proportions of the car were similar to, but not identical to, the 3. It was quite a different looking car. I never liked it quite as well, although it was one that was part of the evolutionary process of getting to the 3. So we had everybody in styling really turned on to that whole program. In fact, I'm sure some of the production cars kind of slipped by the wayside while we were all so fired up about doing this AMX mid-engine program. So we built one model of the two in clay, went through all of the gestation problems of making that happen, and did in fact make a fiberglass model and showed it at the stockholders meeting. It was bright red, and we had this huge sign in the back, AMX/2, the regular figure 2, not a Roman numer. And it really was kind of an upbeat thing for that rather stodgy meeting that we have once a year for the stockholders. But it did give it a platform to be shown. And, of course, the press went bananas over it, and they said, well, is that the car you're going to build? No, that isn't the one we're going to build, folks. We're going to build one that looks a lot like this, but this isn't the actual car, a little bit like Saturn, because the Saturn that's going to come out will not look like the Saturn that they're showing. So to that degree, it was kind of in that sort of vein. And while that car was actually being shown to the stockholders, we already had the car that really was destined to be the turned out to be destined to be the at least planned mid-engine car known now as the AMX 3. And at the same time, I went over to Europe with Jerry for the show at Geneva. And Jerry Myers was very much taken with, impressed by names. And I guess all of us are to some degree, but in any event, he was very much taken by a young designer that was at that time starting to make his mark in the world of automobiles, called Giorgetto Giugiaro. And so we went over to Giugiaro's while we were at the show in Switzerland. We took a side trip. He had already had this lined up, and I knew that we were going to stop by Giugiaro's then kind of grubby shop. It was upstairs over a kind of an old factory, and then a poor part of Torino. He was not very well known at that time, although he had worked for Bertone, and he had started his own business. But it was a very, very small operation at that time. Now he's, of course, huge. But at that time, this is 1968 or 9, and he was really not that well known, although he was getting there. And so we went to see him and met him. I'll never forget when we walked up these stairs, these long, dark hallway stairs, and we were asked to wait in the waiting room by his secretary, who is still a secretary, I believe, to this day. And we were waiting there, and finally the door was opened by who, I'm not quite sure, but we waited about 10 or 15 minutes at least. I know it seemed like a very long time. And this door kind of swung open as if it had kind of blown open. And here's Jojaro, and he was up at the... nobody does this when you're drawing cars. Anyway, he was up at this wall of his office, and he had these illustrations tacked up on a cork board, and he was actually reworking them. He had a couple of flow pens or whatever, and he was actually working them on this vertical board, which nobody would ever do. You know, you got a drawing board, that's what you do, that sort of thing. But it was part of the show, and he kind of looked startled. You know, he's a very good actor. And I looked quite startled. He looked around and, gentlemen, gee, I'm sorry I was so tied up in doing this project for you that at that point he had been asked to do some sketches. I was so tied up, I just lost all track of time. He's doing this through the interpreter who happened to be there too. So it was kind of a charade in a way, but that's part of the game, I guess, at least from his viewpoint. But he is an enormously talented guy for sure. And in any event, he was given the contract to develop with our program, as it turns out, to be an AMX-3. The name wasn't hung on until quite late in the program. It was just AMX mid-engine at that time. So, anyway, this kind of bothered me a little bit, to be very honest with you, because, you know, we had already done the 2, and we had the 3 in clay, and we had this forthcoming meeting in 60 or 90 days, and we were going to show this to all of the product committee and so forth, and here's Jerry. He's going to ring this guy in, and he's going to do a car by, at that time, an unknown. You know, you talk about Jojaro today, and he's world famous, but at that time, he really wasn't that well known. Although I knew of his activities, he was even then trying to become a replacement for Farina, or at least a contemporary of Farina's. And I sense even today that they're in very heavy competition with each other. And Jojaro actually is—he's really doing a terrific job in many, many cars today. He's got a great staff, and he's a very affable, very personable guy. Anyway, and he speaks pretty good English now. He spoke fluent French at that time, and Jerry talked a little bit of French. Spoke a little bit of French, but anyway, he did have this interpreter there. But at this meeting, but at that time, he was given the go-ahead to develop a model and do it in about 60 days, and get it over to our facility here in Detroit within that time frame. And he said no problem, he was going to do it, and in fact he did. And I have documentary photographs of all of this, the cars that we've done, the 2, the 3, and Jojaro's vehicle, and plus some other extraneous versions of the 3 that we did as we were developing and working out the problems with the 3. So I've got all of this in slide form and photographic form too, which someday I'll wind up in my memoirs, I guess. But about on the allotted time or his schedule, we received notification that the car had arrived, his proposal had arrived. Of course, nobody knew what it looked like at all. He was working the same parameters as we were, as far as wheelbase and overall length and height and general chassis layout and things of that type. So we were all working the same drummer. And so we had word, of course, that the great Jojaro's car had arrived at the airport, and we sent a truck out to get it, and it came down to the loading dock in the back by Styling, and the door opened up, and all my guys and, of course, myself, we were all down there with great anticipation to see what this guy had wrought, this great Jojaro, with his already reputation of being a super designer, was going to do. Yeah, it was sent over. It was. Turns out, he worked at that time and still works to a large degree in a rather unusual way of doing sketch models, as I call them, and that's with styrofoam. And it's kind of we used to call them carva cars, and we've done some of that stuff, but it was just his method of doing prototypes. So this door opens up this truck, and we all looked in great anticipation, and this had a cover over it, and they wheeled it out and pulled the cover off on the dock. And it was so bad, it really was, that I really thought that was that he'd done two of them and there was another one still in the truck. It really wasn't very good at all, and I think Jajar would be the first one to admit it today. And of course, he had all kinds of projects at the time, and he kind of worked this one in. I think it was done in his lunch hour or something, because it really wasn't very good at all. It had that louvered backlight, which was really milked to death about that point in time. Big, heavy louvers. And fortunately, that whole situation has gone the way of all flesh. Mostly, you still see some.
You still see it occasionally.
Yeah, you still see them, and they're ugly. I never could stand those things. But I think, really, Jajaro did come up with that, at least some of the cars that he did initially. Back in those years, all incorporated that. Well, it had two things. One was to keep the sun load off the inside of the car, sort of like a, you know, four or five or six or however many they would put on there, sun visors. And of course, they were horizontally positioned with your eye level, so that you look out and you didn't see anything except the section of the thickness of the louver itself. But I always thought they were horrid. They looked like something out of the Pleistocene age or something. With a, it looked a little like a dinosaur. But in any event, here this car was on the dock. It was white. He didn't even paint it. It had, of course, it wasn't a see-through model. It was just like a huge chunk of styrofoam. Two people could pick the thing up very easily. Everything was styrofoam, including the wheels.
You colored?
And it was white styrofoam and black tires indicated, and then black grill openings such as they were. And I've got photographs of all this too, of course. And there were two sides on it, and neither one of them very good. But I don't really know to this day. Someday, I guess, when I have a glass of wine with Jajar, I'll ask him, you know, if he really did that car, because it really, he must have had one of his proteges or something do that, and he walked in the studio maybe twice to look at it, because it was really not very good at all, but we were really kind of shocked in a nice way. It was a good-bad kind of a reading from our standpoint, because, here was this all this anticipation we'd had for nearly 2 months before this thing arrived, and then here this turkey comes out of the oven there.
Can you explain it? Describe it a little bit more in detail.
Well, it was, he did, you know, we never got to the point of checking any of the dimensions, because it was received so poorly by management as well as ourselves. When they saw it, they felt much like we did. They'd really thrown their money away, actually. But it was, it's a little hard to describe, but it was a mid-engine, two-place vehicle with a kind of a fastback with these very heavy louvers on the backlight. It had quite a rounded front end and not much of a grill. Of course, that was true of our cars, too. It was really just an opening below the bumper section.
No wedge.
No, it wasn't a wedge at all, and it was quite a flat back. The fantail area was very cut off, and the front was quite rounded, and it had a very low profile. But I guess we were as disappointed with the model itself as we were with the design of it. At least I was. In the first place, that's the first time I had ever seen in 3D, actually in front of me, styrofoam model. I was disappointed because I somehow felt that he would send something else over, either a clay model. We had no idea what the material of the proposal was going to be at that time. And I thought perhaps it would be fiberglass, which of course is the way we work here, but it was not to be, or epo wood, as they call it, epoxy wood. I didn't know what to expect, but whatever I expected, that was not it as far as the model is concerned and the construction of it. As I say, it was so light that two people literally could lift it up. The one on the front and around the back was very, very light. I don't think the thing weighed 250 pounds if it weighed that. So I felt we'd kind of gotten short-sheeted on the whole program, because I felt, A, that the design was not what I had thought Jajaro would do, and the quality of the proposal was really poor. In any event, we had our car pretty well set at that time, and as far as clay is concerned, and we had in fact pulled our molds off of that, the female molds, and were in fact building up not one but two of the design that we had put together. And I guess I'd probably put more time and personal time into that program than any of the others that I had been involved with there, with the possible exception of the Javelin AMX. Again, my interest in that kind of a vehicle. So I guess I was inspired or, you know, motivated to a large degree, knowing that, and I think that was part of the reason that Jerry did this too, because we had done the 2 and the 3 was just a boring, and he said, well, I'm sure he said to himself, well, you know, I'll really put the screws to Teague and really have him give this whole program his best shot. As I think, you know, in looking back on it, and Jerry, well, I see Jerry frequently, even today, but I know how he operated, and he was kind of a needler, and that was really his job. He was trying to get the best out of everybody, and give them enough competition so they'd worry about that. And I never really worried about it. I just I knew I had so much faith in my people and myself that we could take on all comers. We had done it before with various other outside consultants, and we'd come out on top on each one of those programs. And the others, many of the other programs that we'd had, I kind of set the pattern for what we were going to do, and then come in and kind of ride herd on what was going on. But I wouldn't, you know, really get in there, you know, 6 hours out of the 8-hour day and work on it. But this one, I really threw myself into that one, and because I really enjoyed the program. I'd like to do another one someday like that. I've done a couple with a PPG on some of the pace cars where I was kind of all alone on the track with doing some of those. But anyway, in this one, we had a really good team on that thing, and we had some lovers' quarrels, I guess, as you went through the program with some of the guys, but not too much. They pretty much felt that, you know, that we were doing the right thing, and they knew that I was really interested in this particular program, and so let the boss have his way, I guess.
Can I name some of those guys?
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, of course, number one is Bob Nixon, and he's been, up until the time I retired, he worked for me for 21 years. And, he was exterior design director. And, of course, kind of an unsung hero, and a really fantastic designer who just retired about 2 months ago, Jack Kenitz. Nobody probably ever heard of Jack Kenitz, but he, K-E-N-I-T-Z. And Jack is a fantastic designer and very quiet, humble sort of a guy. But his personality just didn't lend itself to doing much of anything else other than just working on the board and following clay models and doing a hell of a job. And he did that for many, many years. I've known him all of my professional life, I guess, back here in Detroit. He's one of the first guys I ever met when I came back to Detroit. But anyway, he's a good designer, and I would seek his counsel many, many times when I'd come up with something and I'd be having some difficulty working out some surfaces or problems, and you know, Jack would invariably come up with an answer that would work. But I've been fortunate in all my career and having, I think, well, my wife calls me Tom Sawyer, I guess, a little bit, because I've always gotten the most out of the talent that I've had to work with, and I've been blessed, I guess, through the years by having some really, really terrific guys to work with. And I guess if you're a good manager, I guess you get the best out of the guys that are working for you. And we never had the resources, the people resources or the monetary resources to really go out and buy the best talent that we could get. We had to make do with what we had. And we were fortunate indeed in having some guys that were kind of stable as far as not wanting to jump ship and leave us when things got either bad or good. And so as a result, my whole design team at AMC was pretty much intact from, you know, going way back 10 or 20 years even. And we all got along well. I can't really recall anybody making any threatening phone calls in the middle of the night or anything to me. But, you know, you treat people the way you want to be treated yourself, the old golden rule, I guess.
A tribute to your...
No, I don't know if it's a tribute to me. It's just kind of the way I operated. I'd always rather... really get along with people and fight with them, because I think you can get a lot more with honey than you can with mustard in any business. And I was brought up that way, that, you know, if you keep your cool, and you can usually get your own way by other means than, you know, shouting and yelling and jumping up and down and picking up a stick and hitting somebody. You can do it. There's better ways of doing it than that. And through the years, I really have, as I say, to repeat myself, I have been really fortunate in having some really top-flight designers and other technicians, too. Clay Modeler's got it. You're only as good as the people that work for you, but we've had some fantastic modelers, too. We had a guy that was there when I first started by the name of Ron Martin, who was pound for pound a very good modeler and the best modeler that I've ever worked with in my whole life, my professional life. It's a guy by the name of Chuck Hosper, and he's still at AMC. He hasn't retired yet, but he's a little young. Hosper, H-O-S-P-E-R. And he is he's a fantastic guy, because you can give Hoss, as we call him, just a sketch, and if you work with him, he can give you exactly what you want as far as the surface is concerned, or a section, or a roof panel, or a taillight area, or a grill, or whatever. And he's so good. And but unfortunately, we were just talking about this the other day. I was talking to a friend of mine about, you know, it's kind of too bad that you get a guy like Haas. He's in supervisory capacity now. Hosper, H-O-S-P-E-R. And anyway, it's kind of too bad, really, that you get a guy that is so good that you kind of work him out of the thing that he's doing best. We had another fellow by the name of Bob Thacker, who was with me for several years, and he finally went to Ford. He did jump ship, and good move on his part, but he's running the CAD system over to CAD, computer-aided design group over at Ford. And anyway, he was another example of that. They did that to him over to Ford, not at AMC, but while he was with me at AMC, he was a fantastic modeler. He was so good that he left and went to Ford, and once he got over there, he was so good, continuing to be an excellent modeler, that they promoted him to supervisory capacity and lost the thing that he did best. In line with that sort of thing, our friends at General Electric, so I've been told, I read a short article about this in Forbes here two or three years ago, I guess it is now, but they have a program where they, I think it's down in Arizona, where they get these guys, they have a doctorate or whatever, they're very well-educated individuals, and rather than putting them in a management position where they spend all their time going to meetings or writing memos or giving presentations or whatever, they let these guys do their own thing. And they pay them the amount of money that they would be getting if they were a manager or a director or whatever title they would have. But they give them the big money, and they let them do what they do best, whether it's inventing a new widget or whatever it's doing. And that I think is a tremendous, that to me should be done much more in the automobile industry. If it's done at all, I'm not aware of it. Because you really, many times as a Peter principle, or promote somebody to the point where he's ineffective, it's not that they're ineffective, perhaps, and they may, as luck would have it, they may be an excellent manager, and maybe they should have been promoted, and this was just a stepping stone in their talent ladder, but I still maintain that there are a lot of people that should not be managers, but should get the managerial money that a manager would get, and yet they would be of more value, I think, to the company if they were doing really what they were very expert at doing. And I don't know, I always, the same thing is true at Steininger was just very recently, where, of course, we had a little different situation there because we had a union, and once you get a guy that is very good as a modeler or a designer or whatever, and you make him a supervisor, immediately that fellow has to supervise. He can no longer, Jack Kennett's as an example. He was so good that we made him a supervisor, and when the union came in, he had to drop all of his drawing tools, and he had to walk around with his hands in his pockets or a clipboard on, make rough sketches, and that's as much as he could do. He could never make full renderings. The union would file grievances on you before he got the first color on the board, And the guy was a lousy supervisor. He was a guy that was, I mean that lovingly, because he's a fantastic designer, but he's a terrible manager. He couldn't make out, he couldn't check the time cards that the guys made out, because he didn't like it, didn't want to do it. He wanted to do what he did best. And once the union came in there, he was a supervisor at that time. He had to stop doing what he was doing best. He was great as a supervisor. But at that time, before the union, he could draw, he could sketch, he could do anything. He'd put tape on clay, which the union violently objected to. That union, and looking back on my career at AMC, that was a pivotal point in my experience with AMC. It was very, very depressing when that happened. It took them three voting sessions to get in, and they finally did get in by one vote the third time around. It took them about 3 years, and I made the mistake of, in order to, I guess I'm justifying why I did it, but I had to hire kind of they used to call it the leper colony, I didn't call it the leper colony, but we were referred to as a leper colony in a way, because we would take the rejects, the guys that would either let go at some other company or were a personality problem, a prima donna kind of a syndrome or whatever, and we would have to, because we had to have people to do the job, and didn't have the money to go out and steal somebody from another company and pay them a big bundle to come in, so we'd have to take what we could get and try to fix these guys and cure their leprosy. And in many, many cases we did. But in sweeping up a lot of these guys and picking up guys that nobody else would hire, or in fact had in some cases fired, or didn't have the experience, they were neophytes just starting or wanting to get in design, it was kind of a training ground. Soon they'd get good, they'd leave. Until a union got there, then they'd stay because they had seniority and they knew that would protect them. But we had a lot of really bad experiences with guys that we had to do. Not a lot of them. I'd say we had a cure rate of the leprosy problem probably 50 to 60%. It was not much higher than that.
You're talking about modelers.
And I'm talking about modelers and some designers that we took a chance on. And but generally, you know, as I say, we had about 6 out of 10 of them would work all right, but that's not a very good average. But we didn't have any choice because nobody wanted to work for AMC. It was really very difficult at times when we were at a low ebb of sales. And, you know, they thought if they came over, they'd get laid off even before the union. And then once the union got in there, they knew damn well if they came in, they were the lowest man on the totem pole and there was a little glitch in the sales, these guys would be the first guys, you know, to go through personnel out the door. But anyway, that was kind of a bad thing. But getting back to this, if you're good, you know, you might be damn good. Kenneth, I keep using his name, but he was a very good example of an excellent designer, an excellent rendering man. And he had all A's in the right column, except once he became a supervisor, he was really not that good to the corporation. But that's after the union came in. But before the union came in, he was still very effective as a supervisor because he didn't do that much supervising. We had him on the board. He was a working supervisor, as the union call it. And boy, I'd like to have 2 cents for every hour I spent, or my guys, my managers spent, you know, fighting with the union about that one, because they're one of their cornerstones in their philosophy is that, you know, supervisors don't work, they supervise, period. And boy, I'll tell you, that was tough going, and it's tough sledding, it still is. But we did get agreements with them at contract time that they could work in two colors and that they couldn't spend over X number of hours, you know, taking the work away from the downtrodden worker and all that stuff, or the guy that was on the board doing the same sort of thing. God, it was, oh, Jesus, when I think about that, it gives me a headache.
Had that happened to other automobile companies at this time?
No, we stood alone. Mm-hmm. When they got in there, I go back to Jerry Myers again. I'm not being critical, but I'm being factual. When that third vote came up, they lost twice, badly. Well, the first time was badly, the second time was kind of close. And the third time they got in, it was 19 to 18. We had, in that bargaining unit that voted, or in that potential bargaining unit that voted, the unit or whatever they call it, we had a guy that had already told us he was going to leave. He had a job up at in Minnesota, Tonka, and doing toys. And he was a modeler. And he told us that he was going to leave. And it turned out he was a swing vote. He was the 19th vote, and we had 18 against the union, and And with a union vote, however, one, you know, simple majority is it, rules. So anyway, the reason Jerry Myers, when this thing was coming up, I'll tell you, the rules are all with the union. I found that out quickly, because you can't do very much as far as talking to the employees, at least the way the union can talk to the employees, relative to thwarting a union final vote. They have all the cards in their deck, because they can say any damn thing they want to, and you could say only limited things. Otherwise, you get a suit filed against you for
agreement.
Well, more than agreements. Before you even get the vote, you can't do that.
That's
much
right.
Proselyting to, for your own cause.
These are NLRB rules.
NLRB rules, yeah, that's right. So, and they're very pro union, but. Anyway, once the union came in, Jack was working right up to the time, and he'd signed the time cards, and you know, but he'd oversee some things that some of the guys that worked for him were doing when he became a supervisor. But you know, we knew, and he knew, I think, even himself, that he wasn't, you know, he'd much rather be on the board doing things and contributing to the overall vehicle, whatever car he was working on, and solving problems with engineering and with all the rest of us around there. In solving all these problems, he was really good at that. But once the union came in, he was a supervisor at that time. He stopped, for all intents and purposes, the first year of the union. He didn't do a damn thing. He just walked around and you know, pat the guys on the back, and he'd do that even. But he wasn't a super. He couldn't supervise. He couldn't tell somebody else how to do something, and that just happened to be a flaw in his. He had other very positive pluses, but that he was just not good at that. It wasn't his bag. He didn't like it, and he didn't want to do it, and he couldn't do it even if he wanted to. So anyway, I'm digressing here, but the problems that you go through when you're in this business. But still, even the headaches are you know, I never took a Tylenol, but still, even the headaches were kind of fun. So anyway, we back to Myers in this vote. He felt that. You asked a minute ago if, you know, we stood alone in being the only company, I think even today, that had the designers as union members, good old Local 412. And they are in the same group as the clay modelers and the limited number of tech people. We have 3 or 4 people. But Jerry wanted to sweep all of these guys up when the vote was coming up. He said to me, I can remember this like it was yesterday, well, we were only talking modelers and, you know, the 3D kind of guys, the sculptors and the modelers and that group. It was a smaller group. In fact, it was about 20-some people at that time, 24 or something. And he said, why don't you take the designers and put those guys in that voting group, because don't you know they're going to vote against the union? He felt that it was gonna be a ploy on his part, this warp logic, as it turns out. And I said, Jerry, I don't think you ought to do that. Number one, if you put those guys in that, it's against their rule, their wishes, and they're going to be really bent out of shape because you've decided that they're going to vote for us against the union. And I said, I'm not sure that's going to happen. Number one, you're going to tick them off if they think you're doing that to them without giving them a chance to do it. And he said, nah, don't worry about that. He said, I know these guys, so they're professionals. They're not gonna vote with those guys. And I said, yeah. I said, I wouldn't really count on it. And as it turns out, almost to the man, they were, in fact, exactly what I said. They were ticked off that we, management, and I had to be swept into that same category, that we had elected to assume that they would vote against the union and put them in the voting group. And it really bent a couple of those guys out of shape. A guy called me here one night, and he said, boy, he said, I'll tell you what, he said, I wasn't going to, he said, I can't stand the union, I didn't want any part of it, my dad was let go at one time, and he went through all this historical stuff. He said, and he said, I'll tell you right now, T, he said, I'm not going to vote for the company. He said, I'm ticked off that they expect me to do this thing, and they wouldn't give me a choice of making my feelings known, and you guys are putting us in the union.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I'm going to vote for the union. And boy, I'll tell you, he did. And we lost. Okay, once that vote happened, and we lost, 19 to 18, and the bargaining unit came in. It was at that point that whole design section, now that it is both designers and play modelers, it was never to be the same. It was changed completely. There was a line drawn down the middle of the floor, and there was management, and there were the workers. And I'll tell you, I saw personality changes with guys that I just could not believe would happen. These guys became arrogant, particularly the guys with a lot of seniority, because they picked up instant seniority. The guys that had been there for 10 or 12 years, they were just, they changed. Not all of them, but I'll tell you, about 75% of them changed. And they, you'd walk in and they got all these, if they spoke to you after, because we had this one guy that we had to hire who really organized the thing. And he became, of course, an instant, and he's still there. This is 8 years ago now, and he's still there as the district chairman. And of course, he got a steward and a chairman. And these guys, I'll tell you, it's changed in the last 6 or 8 months before I left, because the union movement, I guess, in general in the country is slipping, and they've become much easier to get along with. But when they first got in there, it was really. We went through some times, and we spent more time, arguing about silly-ass grievances than anybody should have. And we could ill afford to do this, to spend all this dialogue and all this time and all these putting out these dumb fires. And they were dumb fires. There was nothing that was ever in all of the grievances that we ever got. That you could almost tell when the contract was coming up, because the grievances would flow like, leaves off the trees in the fall. And they would these asinine, stupid grievances. There were maybe out of the, I don't know, I guess we've had 100 of them in the 8 years. And out of those 100, use that as a reference point, I'll bet you 90 of them were just silly grievances that should have been, could have been solved by simple dialogue with the individual. And, but anyway, that was a real pain in the neck. And it, forevermore, that place was never the same quite after that. We never really had the friendly kind of an atmosphere between the guys and management that was changed so dramatically after that union vote, when we, as I say, lost by one vote. But because when Jerry elected in his own great wisdom to put those guys into the voting unit, that ticked off those guys and gave the union tremendous ammunition to say, well, hell, these guys are, because they wanted the designers from the beginning, but they didn't have much of a chance of getting them up until quite late before the vote happened. And these guys were, I remember one guy in particular, Tom Hale, he was violently against the union. He just, he wrote letters, and he was very articulate in speaking and writing. And he wrote letters to the guys, and he was doing his best to keep them, out of the union. I don't know to this day how many of the designers actually did vote of the 11 or whatever it was at that time, did vote for the union. I'll never know, because it's a secret ballot. But we lost by one vote, and I suspect that at least half of those guys, four or five of them anyway, voted for the union, where there were several that were violently anti-union, but they had to join it once the vote was cast. And it was really too bad, because we stand alone in the industry as being the only group that have designers that are unionized. And that was a sad day, and it's one that I really never quite got over, I guess, because God, I used to have a picnic, and I used to have Christmas parties, and I knew the names of all of the guys' wives and their kids, and they'd have an annual Christmas party, and of course I'd go to that every year, and then they finally just even stopped inviting anybody from management. They put the bulletin board notice up, and the first couple of years after the union, some of the guys would show up, and then you really felt unwelcome to go to that thing if you were a member of management. It was really sad. It was, and we had such a really good working team up until about 8 years ago, I guess, when they voted it in. And
was there ever any looking back realistically? Was there ever a problem of job security with these?
Traditionally, not too much. We did have a couple of peaks and valleys, mm-hmm. and we did. But at that time, if we brought a guy in, say he was a true leper, as I use the derogatory term, But we had a guy that we hired because we desperately needed a pair of hands, even if he might have been 50% efficient. But we couldn't get anybody because they were all working somewhere else, or they wanted to work somewhere else, and they wanted the security of GM, Ford, or Chrysler, and American Motors. Our sales chart looked like a section through our cardiac patient's electrocardiogram. And so we had a difficult time getting top people. We had some good people that were there when I started there, even as 25 years ago. There were a few good people there, not many. We only had, I think, 14 or 16 or something people there when I went to work there in 59. Maybe it was 20, I don't know. There weren't very many. But we always had a difficult time getting people to come to work for American Motors, particularly when we were building Ramblers, like I was saying about my kid. You know, you wanted me to let him off a block from the house. Because most of these guys are young guys. In fact, we had an average age of like 31 years old for the whole group at one point in time. One of the reporters asked me that, and it was an interesting question, and we figured out what the average age was of the guys. 31, which is very young in the by industry standards. Of course, we had less people, so. But anyway, once that thing happened and we went union, it was really never quite the same. It was always that. And of course, we had a couple of firebrand union guys there. This one guy in particular that really organized it and made it happen. He was a hero to the UAW down at Solidarity House. You know, God, he was lionized. They'd send him over to Kenosha for the other meetings. You know, he's a representative of 412, and God, they'd get him girls and whiskey and, you know, whatever he wanted. And of course, he's still from the time the union came in. He's still there. This is 8 years ago, maybe nine, I guess. Time goes so fast. Having fun. But he had a boat, and he'd invite the big beer parties out on the boat, and God, he's got a boat bigger than the where he got that. But anyway, he's got a house up north, and you know, he doesn't earn that kind of money, but still he's very well off, and he cemented the relations very well, because it was a desert vote that happened. This one guy, as I mentioned, that was very anti-union and designer, he felt it was a professional type of a business, and that that was fine for the guys that were modelers and sculptors and guys in the shop and so forth. That was great, but for professionals that they shouldn't be unionizing, he made this big speech to us and to the union. And God, he was, even though he was a member of their group by not choice, but by being folded in because of the vote, they even worked on him to the point that he became, you know, I guess he joined it because he accepted his joining it kind of out of all of the pressures that were put on him. And, you know, they have this inner feeling of, you know, there's those guys and us. And, God, it's really sad. It's a sad commentary on our times. It isn't just, you know, our situation here, but it's prevalent in the movie industry and many others.
The adversarial relationship.
Yeah, it is. It's an adversarial relationship, which is really unfortunate, because it makes it very difficult to get the team spirit going. You know, there's anyway, it's a.
Well, it certainly was a milestone, the first and perhaps only union in the design department.
Yeah, I think to this day it's the. Well, there's union in styling organizations. There's unions in that, but not in the designer area, where the styling guys that are on the board, the styling people, the designers are unionized. That's very rare.
Well, so, back to anyway. the monstrosity from Torino. How did you overcome that?
Well, we didn't really overcome it, because it really wasn't there as a problem. Once management looked at that car, and they looked at the car that we had, which was, well, it took us a couple of weeks to get our car out of the molds and get the fiberglass proposal shell set, and we worked a lot of overtime to get that, because we had we spent a lot more time on our model than he had obviously spent on his. Number one, he didn't have to go through a couple three different phases. He just carved this car and put it in a crate and sent it over, and some accompanying sketches, which also were not very good. But this is a long time ago now. Jajaro has matured, and he's gotten a lot more professional now. He does a really good job these days, because we've used him recently, and he's come out very well in our competition with him. In fact, he's beaten our ass.
Yeah.
But that's another story. But
they're still using a variation of that styrofoam, at least in mock-ups, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. In fact, it's still used. They've got, you know, the years have gone by. It's like 15, 16 years ago now that this happened. And now, styrofoam, in fact, we've done a lot of styrofoam work. We still rely on clay, which is the old tried and true good way of doing it. But styrofoam for a quick picture for aero tests and so forth is great because you can put a gel coat on top of this porosity, which is, of course, prevalent in styrofoam. Mm-hmm. And you can put a coating over that, you can sand it down, you can do, you know, you can put a high gloss finish on the thing, Imron or whatever, and you can come up with a very presentable car. You can make open car, you can do anything. In fact, for a small operation and for quick pictures, it's very good. And that's, of course, what Jajara was doing back then. And but it's the whole technique of utilizing styrofoam and urethane. Of course, urethane is so dangerous that nobody uses that anymore. But it's beautiful stuff to work with. But God, it's lethal. You know, it's that real fine grain stuff. It's Brent Brown. You've seen it. It's beautiful stuff. My God, you can do fantastic carvings, and it's the porosity is so small in it that you hardly see it unless you look at it very close. But it's lethal to use. You get it in your lungs, and you're cooked. So, anyway, this. The Jajara car was there. It was rejected, although they patronized it.